Welcome to Connected Communities, a podcast produced by TCU's Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development. You're listening to episode 2. Connected Communities features conversations about trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI. TBRI is an attachment-based, trauma-informed intervention designed to meet the complex needs of children who have experienced adversity, early harm, toxic stress, or trauma. Now, before we jump into our first series, we're sharing a couple of conversations that give some context about our institute and about TBRI. If you're new to TBRI, this episode is a great place to start. You'll hear a conversation between our host, Sarah Mercado, and Dr. Casey Call, the assistant director at the Purvis Institute and assistant professor of professional practice in the TCU Department of Psychology. This episode gives just a flyover of the principles and strategies of TBRI, but it also gives some great tips on implementation and some resources on where to learn more. So without any further delay, here is our conversation with Dr. Casey Call.
All right, Casey, I'm so excited to chat with you today. You've been really pivotal in my journey with TBRI and how we've moved about implementing TBRI in our family. So I'm excited to get to share this time with you. To kick us off, would you just share with all of us a little bit about yourself, maybe how you ended up at the Institute and what keeps you excited and energized to do the work that you currently do with the Institute?
Sure. So I started out my career working at an inpatient psychiatric unit at a children's hospital in Dallas. And I had a bachelor's degree in psychology, and I really loved working there. But I wanted to do something else. I wanted to help kids more. And so I decided to go back to school and study education. And after that, I was an elementary school teacher in a couple of school districts, and I loved teaching, but where my passion really lied was with those kids that were having a hard time in the classroom. So the kids who couldn't, you know, focus, couldn't pay attention, the kids who were coming from households where the parents, you know, had difficulty supporting them. And so then I went back to school and became a school counselor, and I loved that job. I worked as a school counselor mostly in middle schools, and really, I always told the teachers there, I was like, I don't know how you teach the kids, but being their counselor was super fun. I love to be in on, there's so many changes at that, you know, developmental level. It was so fun to be able to be with them through all of that and to support them through that. And then I had always wanted my PhD. And so I applied and was accepted into a school psychology program. And I was on my way there, and it was the summer before I was supposed to go there. And I happened upon a TCU alumni magazine. And I read about Dr. Karen Purvis and Dr. David Cross and the Hope Connection Camp. And immediately I knew that that's where I wanted to be. And I called Dr. Cross and I said, I just read this article and I am, you know, passionate about helping children, and I would love to come learn more about your program. They were in the middle of a camp, and he said, well, do you want to come tomorrow and check out the camp? And I was like, yes. So I went and I sat in the back and I just cried as I watched Dr. Purvis work with the children. I felt like I had finally found an expert who respected children and was developmentally appropriate. She wasn't coming down with, you know, a my way or the highway type of authoritarian type discipline. She was listening to them. She was providing them with high nurture and really being respectful. And also I loved the environment. I felt like this is what I've been waiting for. This is where I belong. And so instead of going to the school psychology program, I came to the Institute. And I have not left since 2007 because I love it so much.
Oh my goodness, Casey. I just want you to know that the people listening to this are just clamoring to have your experience of, I just called Dr. Cross and he said, you want to come over tomorrow? I just can't imagine what that experience was like. And, you know, obviously that was kind of in the beginning stages of the development of TBRI, and what an exciting time to be involved and to be so active. And I really love to see the videos where we can see you also interacting with the kids with the same respect to their development and right where they are and meeting their needs. So thank you for sharing all of that. I did not know that had happened, actually. I didn't realize that you called him and you were at camp the next day. That's really, really exciting.
Yeah, things have changed a little bit since then.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of thinking like what it would be like to just pop into a camp the day after you called. And now like, it's a little different than that, but nonetheless, here we are. So I would say that most people know that are listening to this, that TBRI stands for Trust-Based Relational Intervention. If you had just the kind of the 30-second elevator speech for what TBRI is, could you share that with us?
TBRI is how we care for families and children. It's based on modeling and proactively teaching healthy relationships. And within the context of healthy relationships, it's providing the structure and the assistance in helping children learn how to regulate themselves emotionally, behaviorally, and cognitively.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So, you know, when we teach TBRI, we actually start by teaching about the brain and understanding the impact of trauma and fear on the brain and what happens when we're in fear, we're experiencing fear, we've experienced chronic fear or chronic traumatic experiences. Can you tell us just a little bit about why it's important for us to know about the brain and how those experiences impact it in order to be able to fully use TBRI?
Sure. I think the biggest takeaway for me about the brain is just understanding kind of the basics. So we talk about the downstairs brain being the brainstem and the limbic system, kind of the reptilian part of the brain. That part of the brain is responsible for emotions and breathing and regulating our bodies. And then we talk about the upstairs brain, which is the cortex. And the cortex is where we have all of our executive functioning skills. So things like planning and organizing and regulating emotions. It also helps us with staying focused, with keeping track of what we're doing, all of those learning new things. So all of those really important skills. And so when we think about the upstairs brain and the downstairs brain, the other important part of this is that the more we use the different neural pathways in our brain, the better they become. So the better connected they become, the more efficient they become. I think about it as like a starting a trail in a forest. And the first time you walk on it, you're pushing the grass down. You're kind of making that trail. But then after it's been walked on, you know, 2,000 times, it's well worn. You can walk faster. You don't have to, you know, it's more efficient. And so the same principle happens within our brain. The more we use different pathways, the better and the more efficient they become. So for me, thinking about those two things is the most important when we think about vulnerable children or children who have experienced trauma, because what happens is they have a lot of practice using their downstairs brain. And that system is responsible for detecting fear. And it, you know, sends their body into a fight, flight, or freeze response. And so when children who come from, you know, less than ideal situations, when they come from a history of maltreatment, their downstairs brain has a ton of practice of recognizing fear, of being able to detect fear. They've got this hypervigilance built in. The bottom part of their brain is really efficient and it's working constantly to keep them safe. And so when their bottom, you know, the downstairs brain is working so hard to keep them safe, then the upstairs part of their brain doesn't have as much experience with all of those skills that we want our children to have, right? How do we have healthy relationships? We have to connect with people. We, you know, the regulation, the planning, the learning. We say, why do we have to tell you this 16 times? It's because that part of their brain is offline. Right? The bottom part of their brain is really well developed and really focused and efficient, but the top part isn't. And I think kind of taking those two things into consideration, knowing the upstairs and downstairs brain, and then knowing that the more we use it, the more efficient and more experienced it becomes, I think are the most important things about brain development.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that, because I know for me as a someone who maybe had to learn how to do things in a more connected and respectful way for kids. That when I learned about the differences in the brains of kids who've experienced harm versus those who hadn't, it was like the moment of that I needed to have to build some compassion for these kids and then understand that, hey, this journey is probably going to be more about me changing the way I do things than about expecting change of kids who aren't in a developmental place to do that change without me. And so I appreciate you saying how we bring all that together to create the best environment for kids and the best opportunity to actually create those, you know, 10,000 steps on the grass with appropriate behavior and appropriate connections and safe relationships. When we think about TBRI, Dr. Purvis told us that kids who have been harmed in relationship need to come to healing through healthy relationship. And so we know the heartbeat of TBRI is connection. And within our connecting principles, we have both the engagement strategies and the mindfulness strategies. Would you start off just talking about the engagement strategies and what they are, and maybe just a little blurb about each one? So if somebody's listening to this for the first time, they could like go and say, I know what eye contact means, and this is why we do it.
Sure. I think one important thing before we jump into the engagement strategies is to think about connecting in a broader scope and to think about the connecting principles are really based on attachment theory. And so attachment theory means we have a special bond with somebody. It means we have a relationship with somebody. We depend on somebody. And so when we think about being in relationship with someone, we're thinking about how two people engage, right? And how their rhythms of engagement add up to this kind of this dance. Dr. Purvis used to talk about the attunement dance, right? How attuned is the child with the people that they're surrounded by, and how attuned are the caregivers with the child? And I think one of the ways that we can do this is by purposefully putting into effect or practicing the engagement strategies. One of the engagement strategies is eye contact, and it's important to remember that we never force a child to make eye contact with us, but we do want to encourage them to make eye contact. When we're looking deep into the eyes of a child, we can feel that connection, right? When we have a safe relationship. If it doesn't feel safe, then that could be one kind of reason why eye contact may be difficult for the child, because maybe adult relationships in the past haven't felt safe. But when you do have a safe relationship, making eye contact can do things like increase dopamine. It shows them that you're listening, so it's respectful. And you're also kind of, you're able to connect and engage with each other through eye contact.
Hey, Casey.
Yeah.
When you say increase dopamine, what does dopamine do?
Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's associated with pleasure and joy.
Awesome. Thank you. So that makes sense why if I look at an adult with gentle eye contact or kind eye contact, that I would get a nice little slope of dopamine. Because for me, one of the hard things about eye contact is that, you know, from my upbringing, it was like, you know, look at me when I'm talking to you. And then often something fearful came into play. And so I like to hear about when we give the appropriate eye contact, like this is what happens in our brain. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that caregivers should be aware of is not asking for eyes only when they're in a corrective moment, but also asking for eyes when you're giving praise and when you're giving compliments and when you're just having a conversation. So it becomes that, you know, that safe relational piece and not that, well, no, I'm in trouble piece.
Okay, thank you for sharing that, because one of the things that I learned in TBRI was that eye contact was not about a demanding of respect. For example, when I grew up, it was look at me when I'm talking to you. And then usually there was some kind of fear coming back at me from the adult, or fear inducing, you know, glare or expression coming back from the adult. And so when I think about the connection of eye contact, it helps me to understand that there is a connection in the brain chemistry when we give appropriate safe eye contact.
So I think about Dr. Karen Purvis, and when she would ask children for hands and eyes when she wanted to talk to them, she would ask for eyes, obviously, for the eye contact piece that we just talked about, but then she would also ask for hands. And one of the reasons that she would do this is because healthy touch is so important. Healthy touch releases dopamine, right? So it can give us pleasure. There's been a ton of research studies, many of them by Tiffany Field at the University of Miami. And so healthy touch helps us to feel good if we've experienced touch as healthy. So again, this is one of the engagement strategies that we may have to start out slow. It may be a fist bump or a high five or a pat on the back or a touch on the arm. And we might be able to work our way up, you know, to things like hugs or side hugs. But healthy touch is really important to it when we engage with children. It helps us to build healthy relationships.
Awesome. Thank you. What about behavior matching?
Behavioral matching is an engagement strategy because it's part of that attunement process. When we see ourselves in somebody else, we feel connected to them. So, I mean, a simple exercise is it makes me think about empathy. So if you see someone crying, your mirror neurons in your brain are saying, or the same neurons in your brain are being activated as if you were crying, right? So when behavioral matching means that we want to match actual behavior. So like if a child is sitting down on the ground and they're upset about something, we're not going to go and stand over them and, you know, be this giant presence. We're going to go down and sit next to them and actually match that behavior. It also means we want to match their energy level. If they come in and they're, you know, kind of low, we're not going to come in super high, like, oh my gosh, it's the best day in the world. How are you doing? Because that would immediately make them shut down. So when we're thinking about behavioral matching, it could also be, you know, if you have an opportunity, I'm thinking about camp. And if you have an opportunity to pick the color of sucker that you want, and, you know, a child picks the cherry one, you could also pick the cherry one, right? It shows them that, hey, we're connected in this really small way, but it's one step in forming meaningful relationships.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I like the behavioral matching because for me, that was an easier place to start in the connecting principles, because it felt less threatening to me than trying to do like healthy touch, which was a skill I had to learn about. Can you talk about the importance of voice and how we use our voice in order to connect with the kids?
Yes. When I think about voice modulation as an engagement strategy, it makes me think about Dr. Purvis again and thinking about how beautiful her voice was when she was, you know, in that playful connecting mode. It was just so sing-songy and you know, soft. And so when we think about how do we engage, how do we create relationships, voice is really important. If we come in and we have a voice that, you know, we're just trying to connect, we're trying to have a conversation, then our voice is a little bit higher and it's faster and it's, you know, more melodic. But if we are, you know, if a child has done something, let's say they, you know, they're supposed to be coming to eat dinner and they're still playing their video games, and we come in with our sing-songy voice, that's not going to make much of an impact. But if we make our voice a little bit slower and a little bit deeper and a little bit more staccato, and we say, okay, you had 2 minutes. Now it's time to get off your video games and come to dinner. That the tone of our voice and the sound of our voice and the rhythm of our voice can convey our intentions, right? So I think it's really important. Many of our children have come from situations where they've been yelled at a lot, or they've been put down a lot, or they've, you know, they've had someone's voice who didn't sound nice, who didn't sound safe. And so one of the ways we connect with kids children is to convey safety within our voice.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And then the last engagement strategy would be playful engagement. But I think we'll come back to that in a little bit. And so if we can move on to chat just a minute about mindfulness. I know that when I first began to interact with the Institute and I was still working in foster care, you asked me to do a presentation on mindfulness and I nearly died. Because all I could find was like people stacking rocks on the beach or doing yoga on the beach, which just seemed like so far out of my reality. So within TBRI, when we talk about mindfulness, can you just, you know, briefly elaborate on, you know, what do we mean when we talk about mindfulness within the context of TBRI?
First of all, Sarah, can I just apologize for asking you to do your first presentation on mindfulness? I'm sorry.
This is good practice.
That was a bad choice. So when I think about mindfulness, I think about two things. So we have to have mindfulness. We have to be mindful of, the adult has to be mindful of their own personal history and also of the present moment. And then we also have to be mindful of the child's history and the child's present moment. So when we think about what does that mean, it means every time we have an interaction with someone, we have to think about where are we at this moment in time? Have we slept? Have we eaten? Are we hangry, right? Have we used all of our patience for the day? Are we completely stressed out by something in our lives? Like, what has brought us to this moment? And where are we right now? Are we in a good place? Can we be well regulated at this time? If not, that's not a good time to start a conversation about, you know, bedtimes or, you know, a difficult conversation with someone. We need to make sure that we are being mindful of ourselves at that moment. But we also have to keep in mind our history and what are the things that trigger us. So when I think about, okay, what are the things that trigger me? One of the things is really loud voices, sounds, talking in the morning. I have no patience. Like, it's just like, I can't deal with it. And so when I know that, then I can be prepared, right? I know, okay, so this is a trigger for me. When I first get up in the morning, I like it to be quiet, right? Once I'm aware of that, then I can do something about it. And so we've got to think about, okay, what is our history and how is that bringing us to this? When I get yelled at, I completely shut down and go into fight, flight, or freeze, right? That's based upon my history. So if someone's using a loud voice at me, we're not going to get anywhere, right? I'm going to be triggered, and that's coming from my past. So we have to be aware of our past, what triggers, you know, put us into that fight, flight, or freeze response. And then what do we do about it? Okay, so I'm starting to get triggered. What do I do? Maybe I take some deep breaths. Maybe I remove myself from the situation. Maybe I listen to really good music. You know, maybe I go get a snack and get some cold water. We've got to be aware of that. That's what mindfulness is. And we also have to do the exact same thing with the children that we work with. So when we're thinking about the children, we have to think about, okay, what's their history? What was their, you know, if they come from a history of maltreatment, what were the smells in their environment? What were the sounds? What are the things that are going to trigger them? And they probably can't verbalize this to you, right? We're going to have to figure that out with them. And so being mindful of that, then when they get triggered, how do we help them to regulate themselves? How do we help them to calm down? And then we have to think, okay, so where are they at this moment? Did they sleep well last night? Have they had food? Have they had physical activity? Are they super stressed about something in their lives? And so I really think it's when we think about healthy relationships and connecting, the mindfulness piece is so important. It is really just the kind of the glue that holds all of the connecting and the attachment principles together.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I like to think of, like, you know, what's the why behind the behavior? We talk about that a lot in TBRI. Like, why is this child behaving this way or this youth behaving this way? And then I like to turn it back on myself and say, like, why does this bother me so badly? Like, what is creating an escalation in me so that I can help to understand, like, what are we really dealing with here? Because what the kid may not be nearly as bad as my experience with what they're doing. So thank you for addressing that. Let's move on to the empowering principles. We know we have two strategies within there, the ecological and the physiological. And we've already talked a little bit about TBRI being, you know, just such a different approach from what a lot of us grew up with. I grew up with sort of an old school consequence and reward. So doing TBRI took like a pretty big mind shift for me. But the empowering principles were an easier place for me to start in my implementation. So could you first talk just, you know, briefly overview of kind of what are we talking about in the ecological strategies and how can we meet those needs within that?
Yeah, sure. I think I agree with you. I think the empowering principles can be a good place for many people to start when they're learning TBRI. And basically what we mean is we're setting up the child and the parent's body for success, and we're setting up their environment for success. And so these are, when we talk about instrumental care versus nurturing care, these are the instrumental, some of the instrumental care things that we can do. So we've got ecological strategies, which I remember it because ecological starts with an E and environment starts with an E. And so ecological and environment is how do we, the things outside of our bodies, how do we set up an environment for a child to help them be successful, right? And so ways that we can do this is one is just to make the environment predictable. Many children who have, you know, who are vulnerable or come from maltreatment have lived in chaotic environments. They didn't know what was coming next. Or when we talk about their brain, they're constantly in that fight, flight, or freeze, that survival mode. They're hypervigilant all the time. So making their environment predictable by giving them a schedule, telling them what's coming up next, structuring their transition. So if we know that in, you know, 30 minutes we have to go to an eye doctor appointment, then we might say, okay, in 30, you know, we might say the night before, hey, you've got an eye doctor appointment. I have to do this with my kids because if I spring it on them in the morning, they are not happy because they've already got their day planned out. So the night before I say, okay, you have an eye doctor's appointment tomorrow. It's at 1:30. We're going to leave at 12:45. And this, you know, to help them get prepared. And then in the morning when they wake up, I say, hey, don't forget, after you eat breakfast, you know, make sure that you get ready. We've got an eye doctor appointment. We're leaving at 12:45. And then 30 minutes before, I give them another reminder. And then 5 minutes, I'll be like, I'll be waiting, you know, downstairs in 5 minutes, we're going to the eye doctor. That helps them to, that helps provide that felt safety, that I know what's coming next. I don't have to be vigilant, hypervigilant about what's coming next because I know and I'm prepared for it. And so having a predictable schedule, structuring transitions, I think providing artifacts. So when we have, I think about like when you're sending your child to kindergarten for the first time, I always think about the book, The Kissing Hand. It's about a little raccoon and the mom gives the little baby a kiss on her hand and the little, so the little baby raccoon has her kiss in the palm of her hand. And she says, anytime you're feeling unsure or, you know, of yourself, or you need some comfort, just pull your hand out because you have my kiss with you. And that is, that's an artifact. So when we think about, you know, maybe putting a little transition object into a child's backpack when they go to school, so they know that it's there, or giving, if a child has, you know, say 10 more minutes, maybe setting a timer or giving them your watch to look at for the next 10 minutes. Or when we're teaching regulation, we make engine plates out of paper plates. And so we might, that would be an artifact. An artifact is something that reminds us of our experience that we've had or reminds us of something that's coming up. It's a tangible memory. Another way we set up a child's environment for success is through our language. Thinking about how we answer questions. If a child asks to do something and we immediately, our first word out of our mouth is no, right? That's going to shut them down. So maybe we can say, yes, you can go play basketball, but first we got to get homework done. So anyway, anything we can do to make their environment set up for success is an ecological strategy.
How about physiological?
The physiological is how do we set up our children's bodies for success? So this includes things like making sure that they have a meal or a snack every couple of hours, making sure that they're hydrated and have plenty of water, making sure that they are getting good sleep and enough sleep. Making sure that they have physical activity. It's all those things that we're doing to set their body up for success.
Yeah, I love that. When I first got to know TBRI and the first time I heard it, like most people, I was just blown away and I was humming along and doing great through, you know, the brain. And that was such a compassion building moment for me, for the kids and their differences. Cause like I said, I came from very old school and I worked in an environment with teen boys where I used a whole lot of structure and very little nurture. And that was what I knew was a really consequence reward system. And so I got so excited about TBRI, but then, you know, I was dealing with my own attachment style as I learned about what all of that meant. And I got to the correcting principles and I was like, hang on, time out. Now this feels like really too kind and gentle. So as I wrestled with that question, I went back to the empowering principles. And I just decided that every day I would have a snack and water for my girls when I picked them up from school. And that I would ignore that list of like, here's 50 questions you should ask your kids when you pick them up from school. Yeah. And so I would just give them a snack and water. And I had like headphones in the car and they had a choice of whether they wanted to talk or just enjoy their snack and water. And all of a sudden I found like we got home and it was so peaceful. And by the time we got home, they were ready to answer all the questions that I felt like I needed to ask to be a good mom, which that's not even true, but it was something I heard along the way and I wanted to be a good mom. So I was trying to check these boxes when what they really needed was to know I was there and going to meet their physical needs and recognize they were tired from their long day. As I was, you know, wrestling to figure out this correcting thing, a lot of that played back into understanding the brain and trauma. But so many people come to us now and all they say is like, just fix the kid, which means fix the behavior. Like if you were to ask them, like, what are you afraid of for this kid, that they wouldn't say little things. Like they're afraid they're going to end up in prison. And, you know, mm-hmm. I just don't want them to get kicked out of school. Like just fix the behavior. And what we've learned over the years is that really oftentimes we fix a lot of the behavior by empowering their bodies and their environment and connecting with them in a healthy way and building that attunement. I love that you talked about the attachment dance with Dr. Purvis, but even with all of that, we still do need our correcting principles, even though I wish we didn't. So within the correcting principles, we have our proactive and our responsive strategies. Can you talk a little bit about the proactive strategies and what that means and why we do that? Because I was really hemmed up on, you know, I'm an adult and I said to do it and the kids should do it. And I couldn't understand why we would need to do a lot of the proactive teaching. So can you talk a little bit more about the proactive strategies and why we do them?
When we talk about teaching proactive strategies, we want to make sure that our child is calm, have we set their body up for success? We want to make sure that they, you know, have eaten, have slept, are not stressed out. So we want to make sure that they're in a calm and alert state. And then we want to practice these things. Again, going back to the brain chemistry or the brain architecture, it's the more that we practice, the more that we use that prefrontal cortex, that those executive functioning strategies, the more that we use those, the more that we practice with them, the more efficient they'll be, the more they'll be able to pull them out when they're starting to get distressed. And so we want to practice, okay, so you get triggered when somebody calls you a name. So let's practice that. We could do that through role play, through puppet play. We can do that through games. I mean, even playing board games like Sorry or Trouble or Uno, you're learning the skills of how to take turns, how to negotiate with people. You're learning how to play as a team player. So we can teach all of these types of skills really proactively. When we want to teach healthy relationships. Okay, so if I have, we might do this through coming up with scenarios and doing it the wrong way first and then doing the scenario again in the right way, maybe with body space. You know, if somebody wants to give us a hug, maybe we teach them, we say, okay, I love giving you hugs, but next time let's ask. So let's practice that. And we have them practice these skills that we want them to learn, these relationship skills, these regulation skills. And we want to make it fun. Right? Because if a child is having fun, if they're enjoying it, they're getting that dopamine, they're in the upper part of their brain. So they're learning and they can't be afraid. Right? So we want to do all of our proactive teaching in playful ways if we can.
Yeah, I really like that. I think that it was one of the things that I kind of learned in the beginning. And one of my favorites was to proactively teach about regulation. And so, because for me, it took a lot of the, you know, I wanted to be able to have higher expectations of the kids than what they were developmentally capable of. And so when I could look back at regulation and, think about like, if I understand how kids learn regulation and that there's a huge part of that falls back on the adult, right? So, I think about proactively teaching regulation and using things like the engine plate and that kind of stuff, which it brings in so much of TBRI, right? Because we're talking about an engine plate, which is an artifact, and, you know, regulation, which is an empowering. But would you expand just a little bit on regulation and how it's developed and maybe how we could proactively teach that?
Yeah, you're making me think of one of my parenting mantras along the way has been, it's my job to help you regulate.
Yes.
And this comes through because when children are really small, we do all the regulating for them just about, right? We have to feed them, we clothe them, we change their diapers, we do everything. So they're completely, almost completely regulated by an outside source or a caregiver. And then as they start to grow and to develop, then we start to co-regulate, right? We might can tell by the way that they cry that they're hungry. That's part of co-regulation. We can tell that when they make this face, they need their diaper changed, right? They might, and then once they start getting language, so they're using their bodies to communicate with us and we're picking up on those cues to co-regulate. And then when they get language, then they can start saying, you know, juice or cold, or if they're bored, we can, you know, do something. So we're learning how to work together to help them regulate, to co-regulate.
Mm-hmm.
And then the co-regulation, you know, depending on the what it is, you know, by the time a child is five, they can get their own cup and pour their own juice, but they may still have a hard time when they get really frustrated, not having a complete meltdown, right? And so we go from externally regulated to co-regulation and then eventually self-regulation. But the timeline varies depending on the task or the developmental outcome.
That's so good. And I know I mentioned an engine plate when we were talking. And so I believe Emily's going to make sure we have resources like that in the notes part of this podcast. So we'll look out for those things. So if I teach proactively, which for me helps me again with the compassion because I begin to understand the differences in chronological and developmental ages of our kids. And then I understand that, you know, I have some responsibility to teach them. And I think back about like how many times when my girls were little did I like give them something and say thank you, you know, and sometimes we still come back to it, right? And so, you know, proactive teaching goes a long way when you can understand the why even behind, you know, why we would do that. But sometimes the wheels do fall off and we need to be responsive in a situation. And so can you talk through and you know, that we have so many resources on our website, on YouTube, and people have a lot of ability to access the information. But could you pick out maybe just a little bit within the responsive strategies, maybe a couple of things that you think it would be really important for somebody to hear who's just learning about TBRI that they could maybe take and practice or do within their environment right now?
Sure. An easy place to start, I think, is with the scripts. And so one of the scripts that we have is to offer choices. And when we offer choices, we are sharing our power with the child. And so it gives them some of that efficacy that we want them to develop, that they're capable of affecting their environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sharing some power and we're also sharing some of the control. I always like to think of it as like the adult is picking kind of the destination, but the child gets to choose the journey. And so if you want, you know, if you're, so I'll give you an example. We were supposed to watch Hamilton last night and we have been planning, and normally we have a movie, you know, a movie night on Monday nights, but we were having it a night before because of some obligations that we had on Monday. And my 14-year-old had a video game tournament last night. And so we were like, okay, we really had our heart set on watching Hamilton as a family, but we also know how important autonomy is for adolescents. So my husband and I were like, why don't we give them a choice? We can either watch it tonight or we can watch it Wednesday night and they can pick. And so we gave my son and my daughter a choice. We said, okay, we can either watch it tonight and you can miss your tournament tonight, because I didn't know what he had going on for Wednesday night, or we can do it on Wednesday night, but there's no getting out of it, right? And so we gave him two choices and they both picked Wednesday night because they just weren't, you know, they had other things to do last night. And so I think giving choices allows them to acknowledge that you're listening to them, you hear what's important to them in adolescence, and that you're making an effort to to listen to them and to acknowledge what's important, but also to, you know, it's not my way or the highway. We want to watch Hamilton. So we're going to get there. It may not be the night that we wanted to, but we're going to get there, right? So we've picked the journey, they or the destination, and they get to help us with the journey. With little kids, it's like, I want them to have a fruit and vegetable at every meal. So maybe your choices are simple. Like, would you like apple or banana? Right? They're getting that practice in making choices, because eventually what you want them to be able to do is to be able to make good choices on their own. So it's kind of part of that regulating again. You're helping them to co-regulate.
So Casey, within the responsive strategies, we have our levels of response. And again, we're just doing a high level overview, but I want to make sure we talk about just being playful and making sure that we stay in play. I think sometimes as adults, we've lost focus on how to play even. And I know playfulness is both in our connecting and our correcting strategies. But if you could just talk about the importance of play and why we need to play so that our listeners can understand why we don't look so permissive when we're playing a lot with kids, even in the hard times.
Yeah, play is so important. It is a child's language. It is how they work things out in their brain. It's how they learn new skills. It is their language. It's how they're telling us what they need, right? And they can do this through a lot of different ways. They can do it through structured play. They can do it through free play, all different kinds of ways. I think one of the most important parts of play is that when we are feeling joy, when we are playing, we can't be scared. Yeah, you can't have those two things going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. So when we're scared, we're in our downstairs brain. When we're playing, we're in our upstairs brain. And that means that we're ready for learning, right? We've got access to the prefrontal cortex. We've got access to that upstairs brain that's going to help us retain new information. It's going to help us make better choices, to focus, to attend, all of those things. So when we are playing, we are open to learning new things. We're also building connection. And we're having fun and we're attuned to each other. I mean, think about throwing a ball back and forth, right? Tossing the football back and forth. Mm-hmm. You've got something that you're doing that you're doing with another person that is rhythmic, that is engaged. Sometimes, you know, you'll have your best conversations when you're doing things like that, or when you're sitting next to each other coloring, mm-hmm. or when you're, outside taking the dogs for a walk. When you're doing something else to engage your brain, and children can learn when they're in that calm, alert state. So playful engagement is really important when we want to teach new skills, and we want our children to be able to take those new skills and actually use them in their environment when they're not in a calm and alert stage, maybe when they're distressed. So mm-hmm. I think another responsive strategy that is good to start with is the redo. Oh, I wish I had known this when I was teaching. Just a simple, can you try that again with respect? Or how about closing that door again and not slamming it this time? Mm-hmm. Can you ask me again in a respectful manner? Just allowing children the opportunity to do it over again without a big hullabaloo, you know? I think those are two places that we can start.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you brought in the sharing power, because as somebody who spent a long time growing up in a very controlled environment and then starting my work with kids, like I had no idea that I was a power and control person. I didn't know it, but I think it was driven a lot by fear. And so when I first heard sharing power and giving choices and stuff like that, and like the kids could actually pick which night we're going to watch the movie, it just felt like almost confusing to me, because I had this like deep down need to be in control. But it's so funny, because once I let go of that, we have brought, it turns out it was me that was disrupting the peace in the household, you know, like just by being so rigid and so stern and not being able to just share that power with the kids and give them a voice. And, you know, I heard somebody said, and I apologize, I don't remember who, but somebody said at some point, like, you know, if we send kids away, if we don't allow them to have a voice, if we even choose, you know, in TBRI, we talk about time ins versus time outs. You know, if we send them away when they're dysregulated and we call it behavior, they're going to find other coping strategies. And one of them is that they're going to learn to go away from us when they're older. And mm-hmm. So I'm just thankful to you, Casey, because you've been such an integral part of my TBRI journey. And, you know, now I'm looking at sending one off to college, and I don't fear her going away to negative coping things. I think she's going to come back to safe adults when things come up, and she already has in her high school career. So I just want to take a moment and thank you for your influence on so many people, but most especially me and my family, because without your dedication to continuing to serve, a lot of us wouldn't have the TBRI that we know and love and get to experience. And so thank you for taking the time to spend with us again today as we learn just a little bit of an overview of TBRI. And there are many other resources that we'll include within the notes section of this. So thank you for your time and for all the information.
Thank you so much for having me.
Connected Communities is produced by TCU's Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development. For more information about the resources mentioned in this show, please visit our website, child.tcu.edu/podcast. Thanks so much for connecting with us today. See you next time.